Good morning. This is, friends, time to begin our journey onto a path called compelling. I've been so excited to share this with you and begin our long walk together, 500 miles, you could say. And as we start, before we jump in, I wanted to back up and just explain why I think this is so important, why this has become a passion of mine, something that I actually wanted to write a book about. I don't know if you saw in the news this week, census data, religions shrinking in Canada again, Christianity shrinking. And it got me thinking, you don't need to be a sociologist or study census data, right, to understand that Christianity in the West is facing very trying times. Young people are walking away from faith. Older congregations are barely holding on. Any church that is growing is actually doing so by transfer growth. Everyone knows that religious affiliation in Canada and the West is shrinking. It's in decline. And to make matters worse, the Christian faith, which I think was once in our culture looked upon with a sort of indifference, is now viewed with suspicion. In Canada alone, the church has been a willing partner in our residential school system, clergy sex and power scandals, partisan politics, resistance to COVID safety measures. This new reality for the Christian faith means, I think, that the trends in decline we see for Christianity and faith are not likely to reverse course anytime soon. And I think this strange new world for people of faith, it provokes many different emotions. For some, there's like a fear and anxiety over Christianity's fate. And for others, I think there's just confusion, resentment over how the Christian faith has been used to hurt others. There's also confusion about what this means. We know we need to change, but what does that look like for our time? Well, in previous generations, right, I think the best way that Christians thought to engage the world believers was through rational argumentation. But those efforts largely failed. And in the cultural milieu that we're in right now, suspicion and religious pluralism, I would say this: no one wants to be converted, especially by losing an argument. And so what I hope to do through the course of this series is, for me, it's a bold and new apologetic for the Christian faith. It's an attempt to demonstrate not how the Christian faith is right. What I hope to do is give us a stunning portrait of why the Christian faith is compelling. I hope to help us discover a faith that feels more like an adventure, that road trip you've always wanted to take. Because I'm convinced by this, being compelled by something will always be more powerful than being converted to something. And so this series, you could say it's my attempt to offer us a map, a compass, a guide to help us navigate our way into what I hope is a brighter future in Canada. And I hope this series can help us recover from the scandals and shame of the church. I hope eventually this might be a rallying cry for a new generation of Jesus followers, a companion for those of us who feel like weary travelers. And so that's where we're going from now till Easter. And I want to play the part, my role in this, I hope to be sort of part expedition guide, part raconteur, you could say, part pastor, part seasoned park ranger, helping us get lost in stories and wisdom about a terrain and a trail we know, but know that we also need to rediscover. So to that end, we are headed onto a path called compelling. I took time to draw up a little map for us here. It's hard to read, but this is where we're going. This is where we're in the bottom right now at the trailhead. And we're going to head through the Incarnation Cave, into the Identity Baptism River, into the Temptation Desert, up through the Transfiguration Mountains, down into the Garden of Trust, in through the Hills of Crucifixion, and then into Resurrection Country. That's the trail that we will be heading on. And it's a path that mirrors the landscapes of the key events of Jesus' life. But before we set foot on the actual path, what I want to do is spend a little time at the trailhead, sort of like gathering at the trailhead together. Let's have a little group meeting at the trailhead together. Talk about paths and things that compel us. And a lot of this started with this conversation I was having with a downtown planner for Kitchener. I was meeting with her, and we were talking about the revitalization in Kitchener's downtown core. And then it got more personal. So she said to me, "So you're a pastor, eh?" And she said it with that smirk, like, you know, just a bit condescending. And I explained a bit about what I do. And then she said, "You know, I'm a very spiritual person, but I just don't get religion." And I noticed that she had an amber-colored stone flipping through her fingers. I asked her, what's this about? And over the next 20 minutes, she explained to me that she's very into rocks, crystals to be exact. The one she was rolling over in her hand was a carnelian stone, and it's a general healing stone. There's also rutilated quartz that's good for healing while releasing troubled thoughts and feelings. Turquoise is for spiritual attunement. Low light helps one stay in the moment. And she carries around these crystals with her, drawing on their energy properties throughout the day. And when she got done her 20-minute rock tutorial, I was both enthralled and amused. I'd never heard anyone speak so passionately about rocks before. And yet it was the comment at the end of our conversation that really stuck with me. Reflecting on my faith, she said this, "I don't get Christianity. It feels like it's all about beliefs. These crystals for me represent a way of life. That feels bigger to me than personal beliefs." Ah, she'd said it. There it was. I can't tell you how many times I've heard a variation of the claim. Somehow energy crystals, hot yoga, essential oils, sport parenting, the keto diet, all of these things have become a way of life, while Christianity is apparently merely a set of beliefs. It's a refrain that I hear often. It's like, sure, if you're looking for a set of beliefs in life, sure, Christianity might have you covered. But if you want something bigger than what you mentally assent to at any given moment, well, you might want to look elsewhere, like rocks. And in my mind, we've allowed the Christian faith to remain a set of beliefs for too long. Christianity is more than that. It is a way of life. It provides a path and direction for living, moving, operating in our world. And while I happen, of course, to think that a person's core beliefs shape the way we live in the world, the Christian faith, I don't think, has always done a great job of connecting the two. And my hope is that the series might help connect those dots, you could say. Ontario's escarpment country, I don't know if you know this, home to over 100 waterfalls. Hamilton alone is home to 145 of them in Hamilton. Of course, the biggest, most dramatic in escarpment country is Niagara Falls, right? But the region has scores of charming and far less touristy waterfalls waiting to be discovered. And my favorite, too, are, of course, in the Spencer Gorge in Dundas, Ontario. Webster's Falls and Two's Falls. They're only a couple miles apart from each other. And the streams from their basins twist and careen, and they finally join up into one single stream bed, the Spencer Creek. And Chris and I used to spend a whole lot of time hiking when we were dating in this area. And I asked Kristen to marry me at the place where the two streams become one, which I thought was right, you know, that's what I thought. Not bad. Maybe a little cheesy in hindsight, but it worked. She said yes. Years later, I'm hiking solo on my own, and I find myself at the top of this secret ravine. You gotta jump over a fence to get to it, hike out to this secret ravine. And it dawns on me, oh my goodness, I think 150 feet below me is the place where Kristen and I got engaged. I craned my neck over the edge to see if I could see it. Everything was lost in trees and rocks. Ah, man, I'd like to get down there. And that was when I made a poor decision. The descent to the river below seemed sharp from where I stood, but it didn't seem to be an altogether impossible task. I figured I had the climbing abilities, I mean, look at me, to be able to get down there on my own. I figured I had what it took, spend some time there, hike out before dark, you know, all's good. But I was wrong. I had taken barely 5 tentative steps off the edge when everything around me just collapsed in an avalanche of small vegetation and dirt and little trees. I was swept off my feet, cascading down the edge of this cliff, and panic filled me as I tried to grab hold of something solid to hang on to. And I'm picking up speed, and I can see in front of me there's a vertical cliff. If I hit that, I'm going to fall at least 30 feet onto boulders below, and I'm desperate, like primordial fear in me, sheer terror. And I rush towards the cliff face, grabbing at everything, and right as my feet and chest lunged off the cliff's edge, I just die for this little sapling tree, hoping it would hold, and in the moment of truth, oh, it held. And I'm hanging from a cliff by this little tree, praying to it, thank you, little tree, thank you. And then I realized, oh my goodness, I still got a 30-foot cliff to get down to, but it was very jagged. There was lots of easy step holds there, so I took my way down the cliff, climbed down slowly, got to the bottom, and I just collapsed. Just, oh my goodness, that was too much. My heart rate was calming. I'm like, okay, I survived. But then a new dilemma dawned on me. I had been expecting there to be two streams when I got to the bottom that connected, but there was nothing. I had seriously mistaken where I was from my perch up above. The spot I was hoping to get to, it wasn't anywhere close. I couldn't even hear a stream or river. I was lost between two falls. And I spent the next 2 hours hiking in what seemed like circles, trying to find my little spot, but I couldn't find anything. I had no clear sense of where I was. And when I finally stumbled up the river, I got somewhere else, found a little path that didn't take me where I wanted to go. I hiked back up to where my car was and spent the whole ride home licking my wounds. How had I gotten so lost in the forest? Nursing my bruised ego, trying to figure out, I miscalculated. I become completely lost. And I realized that day, the reality was I needed a path to follow. I thought I could save time, right? Like, I didn't want to hike all the way around down the gorge to our little spot. I thought I could save time navigating my own way there. I thought I didn't need the help and guidance a path could offer me, but it was very, very wrong. It was naive of me to believe that I could just bushwhack off trail, right? Find my way. And I'm inclined to think that, like my hiking experience, so many of us today wander through life aimlessly. Sort of greet every day with not a clear direction, but just sort of bushwhacking it through life. We head into the woods of life expecting, I'm sure I can navigate. I think the consequence, though, is that it leaves many of us, when we start tracking our years, going, where am I headed exactly? It leaves many of us feeling like we're lost. We don't have a great purpose in life. And if you're not careful over the years, what can happen is you stop and go, my goodness, it feels like I've been walking in circles. Or as Lillian Bell would say, we greet each day like one damn thing after another. Far too many of us head blindly into the woods of life thinking, hey, we can manage independently without considering the wisdom of a path, a trail. But as in hiking, so in life, a path promises to take us somewhere. So imagine this. Imagine you are dropped off in a large forest on an overcast day. You can't see the sun, you've got no navigational cues in front of you, and you're told to head east without the aid of a compass, trail, or path. You've been left to navigate on your own. Now, in that scenario, how many of you do you think you would get very far? If you're like me, you think, oh, I'd be fine, I'd fare well enough. Well, what happens when people are lost in the woods? I think this researcher, Jan Suman, has the greatest job ever. I don't know how he got this job or how he thought of it, but his job is this. Over the years, he takes people and he performs experiments on them on how they travel without navigational cues. So what he does is simple and revealing. He takes people out to thick forests when there's no sun in the sky, it's an overcast day, or places like the Tunisian desert, and he drops them off, straps a GPS device to them, and then just watches what happens. Here's the result of one experiment he did in a German forest. All of the subjects were told to head east. Yeah, they didn't fare so well. Only SM on the screen was able to hike on a day when the sun was visible. The differences between their routes are striking. He ditches these four people off on different days, no navigational cues, and, well, they walk in circles, they certainly walk in the wrong direction. And what he's learned throughout his research is that without a path, trail, or navigational cues, we get lost. And the results are mind-boggling to me. This one is just crazy. His research and experiments reveal that, on average, people who are lost without external navigational cues will typically not travel farther than 100 meters from their starting point, regardless of how long they walk. Think about that. No farther than 100 meters from your starting point, regardless of how long you go. That's sensational. Without a path, a trail, navigational cues, we get lost. And I would suggest this is equally true in most of life. Without a path, we don't get far. There's wisdom in traveling on a path. And we risk, without a path, spending our whole lives just walking in circles. And so, why be Christian? I start here and I joke that this might be the worst apologetic ever. But this is where I start. Why be Christian? We all need a path to travel in life. We won't get anywhere without one. And there's lots of talk. You say, okay, fair enough. Maybe I can buy in that we need a path. But how do I know whether the Christian path is the best path or the only true path? The truth is this, I don't know. I got hunches. Certainly believe there's much to commend itself about the Christian path. Even still, in all honesty, I don't know. And over the years, many Christians have told me they find this incredibly disturbing to hear. You're a pastor and you're not sure? I find the confidence of those who believe only their path is the true one equally perplexing. But I find it on the flip side. I find those who think all paths are the same or made of the same features troubling. No doubt you've all seen this comic, this illustration before. I find it very disturbing. It's like, look at all these blind religious people. That one thinks it's a rope, that one a wall. Meanwhile, apparently the observer is just a, I can stand outside of this and see all religions are just blindlessly discovering the same thing. It's like, really? Who are you to be outside? I just think thinking that all paths and trails are the same just lacks humility and honesty. And so I would say this, you can call me an agnostic Christian if you like, fair enough, but I start here. I don't have any certainty around which path is best or most true, or even whether every path ultimately leads to the same place or maybe nowhere. I don't know. But I'm confident we all need a path in life. Ernest Ingersoll once wrote, "A trail is a happy promise to the anxious heart that you're going somewhere and are not aimlessly wandering around in a circle." Why be Christian? Because we all need a path to travel on in life, and the Jesus path has something compelling to offer. One of my favorite reads over the past, it might be more than 5 years now, but Robert Moore's On Trails and Exploration. I can't recommend this book enough. It's just a tribute to the wonder and beauty of trails, from the trails that ants travel to humans. It's just a gorgeous book dedicated to the beauty of trails. And it helped me understand what I had been sensing so long about the Christian faith. Moore says this, "Throughout the animal kingdom, trails function as a form of external memory, so they follow them. Animals follow paths simply trusting that the destination will be worthwhile." And in his book, he highlights a fascinating story about this from the country of Botswana, a country in the southern regions of Africa. And in the animal kingdom, migratory paths are essential. The paths exist to keep you alive. They lead to water and food. And so trusted tracks and migratory paths, they're critical to the survival of animals. But in 1968, in Botswana, the government erected hundreds of miles of wall that year that cut off the zebra's migratory route. It had devastating effect on zebras, a bunch of other wildlife, but this is the exciting thing. The government tore down those walls in 2004, and when they did, the zebras resumed their migration route 36 years later, which is astounding because zebras only lived to 12 years old. That means that three generations of zebras had passed since the government cut off their path. Somehow, they managed to find their way again. How? Leading theory is elephants. Elephants live to over 50 years old in the wild, so the idea is that as the walls came down, the elephants of Botswana, they're like, oh, we know the path. They recreated the game trails, and the zebras just followed, because in the animal kingdom, paths always lead somewhere important. If they didn't, a path would stop being used. Paths are the way that we survive and thrive. To follow a trail is to work from the wisdom of those who have come before us. To follow a path is to build on the knowledge of those who have come before us. And some of Moore's words in his book struck me as so powerful because they perfectly capture the immense wisdom of walking on a path. He says this, "It is impossible to fully appreciate the value of a trail until you've been forced to walk through the wilderness without one. A path is a way of making sense of the world. There are finite, infinite ways to cross a landscape. The options are overwhelming and pitfalls abound. The function of a path is to reduce this teeming chaos into an intelligible line. Complete freedom, it turned out, is not what a trail offers. Quite the opposite. A trail is a tactful reduction of options. On a trail, to walk is to follow. Like prostration or apprenticeship, trail walking both requires and instills a certain measure of humility, and both the religious path and the hiking path are made in the walking. Use creates trails. Long-lasting trails, then, must be of use. To me, that's revelatory. I mean, next time you're out hiking, remember these words. You'd be like, who made this? Why does it go this place? And this also changes for me how I see the Christian faith. Whether hiking through the woods or simply trying to decide how to live, there are thousands of routes we could take. And that sounds like freedom, because it means we can travel, we can do whatever we want. The trouble is, as we've seen, the supposed freedom of being able to walk wherever you want, well, it often ends up being restricting. You don't actually get anywhere. You get lost, wander aimlessly. You end up close to where you started. A path reduces your options dramatically. It might sound restrictive, but it also promises the freedom of taking you somewhere. And so to choose a path is to reduce our options, but it's also a commitment to movement and direction and growth. Consider marriage. When Kristen and I got married, neither of us could know whether our decision was sound or not. Marriage is a big gamble. And at the time, we enjoyed each other's company, we got along well, we were attracted to each other, but is that enough to base a lifelong decision? Especially since marriage vows include continuing to love each other even when things change. I'm inclined to think not. And I was reminded of that this week. We got a 2018 Tucson back in May, because the Corolla is always on the edge of death. And I'm so bad with cars, I don't know how to change the presets, but I noticed getting into the Tucson that every time I turn on the car, the country music radio station came on. I'm like, this is weird. Whoever owned this car before is annoying. So I was got to switch it. But then, this week, I got into the old Corolla, and I have had the radio station's preset for over a decade. Number 5 is CBC. Know exactly where that is. 102.1, number 1. And I got into the car, and CBC was a radio station, a country radio station. All the presets had been changed to country music. I had to confront her. I said, Kristen, and she tried to lie. I said, Kristen, what's going on? Why are they? She's like, oh, when we got the battery changed, it must have reset. I said, no. Don't start with me. I said, are you? And she said, yes, I'm a country music fan. I'm like, If I had known that when we were dating, it could have changed things drastically. Oh, my goodness. I'm still disturbed. Think about it. Marriage is a commitment to a relationship where you find you might no longer enjoy each other's company or get along well or find each other attractive. Marriage is an absurd gamble. We decide that of all the people in the universe, in the world, 7 billion of us, that this one is the best? When Kristen and I got married, neither of us could know whether there might be others in the world who might be far more suitable to our personal needs, our desires, and tastes. Even still, we went ahead with this, the decision. Why would we do that? Why would any two rational people do that? Because marriage is a tactful reduction of options. And marriage isn't beautiful because it makes sense. It doesn't. Marriage is beautiful because it's the freedom to say, while there could be better options, I choose you. I choose to spend my life exploring the terrain of our relationship, knowing there's going to be peaks and valleys. Even still, I'm reducing my options to have the freedom to know and grow and travel in love with you. And so marriage is absurd in that it dramatically reduces our options in life, and yet marriage is also liberating in that it gives us direction. gives us a specific individual to focus our love and affection on while learning love and mutuality. And it's the same thing with a path. You narrow down your options and possibilities, and there's incredible freedom in that. We can't have it all in life. Trying to pursue it all leaves us lost, not free. We all have to choose at one point. And here's the thing, we all will, consciously or unconsciously. There comes a time when a person has to choose, be it in hiking or marriage or life. This is the path I'm going to choose. And for me, a path is the Christian path, the Jesus path. And from what I can see and want to show you over the coming weeks, I think there are great reasons to believe it is a tremendous path to travel. See, there's this passage in the book of Jeremiah that I love because of its trail imagery, of course. And in Jeremiah, the people of God, the people God is working with, they have gone bushwhacking. They've gone off in the woods. They've gone off trail. It's left them in danger. They've wandered away from the path God has called them to. And now they find themselves on the verge of disaster, coming under siege from the giant empire of the day, Babylon. And they won't listen to God. They won't listen to Jeremiah. In real danger, God pleads with them one last time. Return to the path. Return to the path before you decided to swing out on your own, thinking you could make it on your own in the woods. This is what God says in Jeremiah. Stand at the crossroads and look. Ask for the ancient paths. Ask where the good way is and walk in it, and you'll find rest for your souls. Like these ancient people God was speaking to then, I trust God is saying the same thing to us today. Travel this path I created for you. Because outside of it is just aimless wandering. We all need a path to travel in life. Again, for me, it's the Christian one, or as I prefer to call it, the Jesus path. And throughout the rest of the series, I want to serve as a bit of a trail guide, offering some insights on my experience traveling the path, thoughts on what lies ahead for all of us, what sort of terrain we can expect to travel, what we can expect to encounter, of course, where this path claims to take and lead us. Like many of us, again, we live in a time of suspicion around the Christian path. You might have serious doubts. You might be concerned about things you've heard or read about the Jesus path. You might find the subcultures and political wrestling matches this path has seemed to spawn confusing, annoying, even downright revolting. Maybe some of its terrain seems beyond comprehension to you. I understand the many doubts and frustrations people have with the Jesus path, because I struggle with the same things, but I find encouragement in how Robert Moore sums up his frustration with trail walking here. He says, you skirt down a ridge only to climb it again. You climb a steep peak when there's an obvious route around it. You cross the same stream three times in the course of an hour for no apparent reason, soaking your feet in the process. You do these things because someone, somewhere, decided that's where the trail must go. Trail walking both requires and instills a certain measure of humility. And that's how I've come to see my frustrations and doubts and misgivings about the Jesus path. Yep, my feet get soaked regularly. There are times when it feels like I'm crossing the same stream, unaware of why it should be. That's just the nature, though, of following a path. It's exasperating at times. And we wonder, might there be a better way? Of course, that's natural. But as Moore reminds us, trail walking both requires and instills a certain measure of humility. Going to ask the band to come and close us right now, but I'll end simply saying this, a highlight for next week. It's one thing to know that we need a path in life and that the Christian faith offers one, but that doesn't seem sufficient because most of us, when we hike, we choose our trails. Why? Because of where they take us or maybe the aesthetic around it. And so I'd say this, we need a path in life, but we also want to travel compelling paths. So if you're standing with me at the trailhead, stick with me a while longer. We're going to talk about why this trail is so compelling, and then it's time to hit the path ourselves.